Hi, everybody, and welcome to Context Countdown. I'm Andrew Kripko, and I'll be going over 5 recent news stories that need to be placed in context. Some of them are misleading, while others are spot on, but either way, there's a context behind them, and I'm here to tell you what's really going on. Let's take a look at our top 5 countdown for the week. At number 5, we have China expressing an interest in joining the TAPI gas pipeline. Pakistan's Daily Times reported that China would like to build a branch line through the neighboring country once the original project is completed, which would apparently be less costly than constructing another one directly from Turkmenistan. In the event that it comes to fruition, which remains to be seen since TAPI itself is far from finished and was discussed for years before any progress was even made on it, then the Chinese destined line would represent a complementary energy component of the CPEC series of mega projects that it would be running parallel to. It would also open up the possibility for Russia to play a crucial role in this initiative and therefore strengthen the multipolar trilateral that's forming between itself, Pakistan, and China. Russia is currently constructing the north-south gas pipeline from the southern port of Karachi to the central city of Lahore, and it also has plans to build an Iran-Pakistan-India gas pipeline too. Moreover, Pakistan just discovered oil reserves of a disputed but nevertheless impressive size near the Iranian border, and newly elected Prime Minister Imran Khan told the Russian ambassador during a meeting last week that his country's energy companies are welcome in Pakistan, thus raising the possibility that Moscow could get involved in this exciting opportunity too. The bigger picture that's forming is that Russia might have a competitive chance to build TAPI's Pakistani transiting portion to China in the coming future by expanding its existing in-country projects to the People's Republic. With or without Russian participation, however, the very proposal of constructing a TAPI branch line through Pakistan to China underlines the South Asian state's connectivity significance and proves why it could rightly be described as the zipper of pan-Eurasian integration. Pakistan's geography, as proven by CPEC, endows it with the possibility of connecting the Eurasian landmasses, various integrational blocks of the Eurasian Union, SARC, the ECO, and the SCO, therefore making it the center of strategic gravity between them. Expanding this concept even further into the energy dimension through the proposed CPEC parallel pipeline could give all of the participating countries an even greater stake in Pakistan's future success, and consequently lead to the formation of even greater security ties between them. The next one up is the unrest in the Somali region of eastern Ethiopia. Federal forces intervened in this geographically expansive but sparsely populated region last week in order to restore law and order there after the state's government challenged the central authorities by provocatively deploying their Liyu counterinsurgency forces to the federal city of Dire Dawa. Former Somali Regional President Abdi Mohamed Omar's heavy-handed tactics against the previously banned Ogaden National Liberation Front stand in stark contrast to the reconciliatory reforms of new Prime Minister Abiy, who recently removed the group from the government's terrorist list. But the latest conflict was sparked more by a simmering deep state power struggle within the country and less by the region's legitimate security concerns. Apart from some of the officials in the Tigray region, the former regional president was considered by many to be one of the last visible representatives of the hardline faction of the ruling coalition that has been rapidly swept aside by Prime Minister Abiy's fast-moving reforms. And it's possible that he and his backers wanted to see how far they could go in resisting the new government. The central authority swiftly dealt with this dangerous insubordination and detained President Omar, but not before some reprisal attacks were carried out against minorities in the region, which could have catalyzed a balkanization chain reaction in the ethno-regionally fragile country during this sensitive political transition had the violence not been contained. Regional President Omar's removal is being received very positively because of the notorious reputation that he built for himself over the years through what his many critics claimed was his propensity to use disproportionate military force against the ONLF. Though it must be said that this group briefly attempted to opportunistically exploit the federal intervention in a last-ditch attempt to increase its post-conflict negotiating leverage with Addis Ababa, but eventually moderated its position and agreed to a unilateral ceasefire. It's unclear at this moment whether they'll compromise on their separatist stance, but it would be in the best interest of the country if they seriously considered it. Prime Minister Abe is leading a peaceful revolution that seeks to substantially decentralize the formerly rigid state and consequently allow for the inclusion of non-traditional actors in its governing apparatuses as it transitions to a functional democracy, hence the removal of the ONLF and a few other prominent groups from the government's list of terrorist organizations so that they can participate in this process. Theoretically, the end result could see each region receiving more political and economic autonomy, which could dramatically improve the standard of living in the Somalia region if this led to the clinching of a revenue-sharing agreement with the federal center. The roughly 8.5 million people that inhabit this part of the country are estimated to be sitting on $7 billion worth of natural gas exports a year, which will reach the international market via a pipeline through Djibouti, while its oil reserves there could pass through Eritrea via a newly proposed UAE-built pipeline. The Somali region is also important as a commercial transit route for the Chinese-built Djibouti-Addis Ababa Railway, and Ethiopia's forthcoming access to the port that it's jointly constructing with the UAE in neighboring Somaliland's Berbera. If an equitable economic arrangement could be reached between the central authorities and the Somali regions, then the locals would undoubtedly benefit. Former regional President Omar's removal makes this possible and could allow Prime Minister Abe to finally begin making serious progress on implementing this vision all across the nation as he strives to pioneer an Ethiopian renaissance and turn his cosmopolitan country into an African great power, though provided, of course, that the remaining hardliners in the Tigray region don't stand in his way. Third on our countdown are the five countries of the Caspian Sea region signing an agreement on the body of water's official status and agreeing to work together with one another to prevent conflicts. President Putin hailed the Convention on the Caspian Sea's legal status for its landmark significance because it's the first time that all the relevant states agreed on something of consequence concerning this topic, which importantly included banning the military forces of extra-regional states and creating a Caspian Economic Forum. RT quoted Russian expert Andrei Grozin as saying that the Iranian position hampered signing the Caspian Sea Convention for a long time, end quote, and praising the Islamic Republic's leadership for making the necessary concessions to finally bring this about. But President Rouhani cautioned that not all issues were resolved during the summit, and that, as he put it, negotiations on delimitation of the Caspian Sea should continue among the littoral states. His comments were in response to the fact that while surface issues were agreed upon, the seabed ones remain unresolved, and therefore it's unclear whether the long-discussed Trans-Caspian pipeline between Turkmenistan and Azerbaijan has finally received the international legal approval to be built. In any case, and looking beyond this important ambiguity, it can be analyzed that the intensification of multilateral pressure along Iran's western flank in the Mashriq may have contributed to Tehran reconsidering some of its other formerly rigid positions towards the Caspian Sea, and subsequently softening them in order to create inroads for an eastern pivot that could revolutionize Eurasian affairs. The institutional overlap of the Eurasian Union, Economic Cooperation Organization, and SCO integrational bodies between the Caspian Sea's five regional states creates a solid basis for advancing the Golden Ring vision of a comprehensive partnership between multipolar great powers and the Central Asian republics, using the Caspian Economic Forum as one of its inter-organizational platforms. Relatedly, this new forum also facilitates the linking of the previously disconnected Lapis Lazuli, BTK, and Via Carpathia east-west trade corridors, and closer coordination between the five littoral states to develop the north-south transport corridor with India. So long as Iran remains cooperative and it has every self-interested reason to be, then the Caspian Sea could become crucial to multipolarity. Our runner-up are the sketchy UN reports alleging that China is presently holding a whopping 1 million Uyghur Muslims in so-called re-education camps. Gay McDougall, a member of the United Nations Committee on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination, cited what she claimed were unspecified credible reports for making this dramatic claim, which is likely a gross exaggeration but based on some kernels of truth, as most Infowar attacks are. In a perfect world, there would be full transparency and the international community could get down to the bottom of what's really happening, but China has legitimate security concerns that necessitate a secretive approach to this sensitive issue. And it also has the sovereign right to not have to answer to anyone when it comes to its anti-terrorist policies in Xinjiang, which have been wildly speculated upon by the Western mainstream media for the past couple of years. Whatever it may be that's really happening there, the state needs to be careful that its reaction doesn't fuel a worse problem by inadvertently creating genuine grievances where there previously were none, which is what the art of counter-hybrid war strategies, also known as democratic security, tries to avoid. It should be mentioned that this region is also the main continental hub for China's One Belt, One Road global vision of New Silk Road connectivity, and is the access point for the country's overland commercial engagement with the Muslim states of Pakistan, Central Asia, and further afield, Iran. It's with this strategic significance in mind why external actors periodically focus on reviving interest in the Uyghur issue. There are, of course, some people who are legitimately worried about what's happening in Xinjiang, but they could unwittingly be exploited as useful idiots for promoting weaponized fake news infowar schemes designed to sow distrust between China and its Muslim partners, like the ridiculous claim that 1 million Uyghurs are imprisoned in so-called re-education camps is apparently designed to do. The problem, however, is that China has always had difficulty convincingly responding to these reputational attacks and managing international perceptions about its internal affairs because of the nature of its governing system, which prioritizes security and secrecy over the Western notions of democracy and transparency, which isn't a judgmental observation, but just an objective assessment of its structural shortcomings when it comes to safeguarding its soft power. At our top spot, we got the orchestrated crash of the Turkish lira. The country's currency is being subjected to a coordinated attack from abroad, most visibly triggered by Trump's steel and aluminum sanctions, but also being due to systemic factors stemming from the government's freewheeling economic policies over the years. The focus of this analysis is more about the political implications of this crisis than its technical origins, but those who are interested in the latter should reference Moon of Alabama's article about how Turkey's currency crisis came to pass, which does a spectacular job summarizing the complex confluence of factors that facilitated the U.S.'s asymmetrical destabilization of its nominal NATO ally. The lira was already in trouble even before Trump's latest sanctions, but these restrictions sent it tumbling even further because of the fears that they provoked of an impending economic collapse and the resultant speculation associated with that scenario, which had the inherent effect of dooming confidence in this currency. Moreover, it's obvious that the U.S. has ulterior motives because it had only recently politicized the arrest of the so-called pastor who was detained nearly 2 years ago on charges of being an American spy who conspired with the Gulen movement and the PKK against the Turkish government. Interestingly, former American ambassador to Ukraine during Euromaidan and the U.S.'s current top diplomat in neighboring Greece, Jeffrey Pyatt, pressingly predicted back in April that his and his host country's ties with Turkey would experience what he described as turbulence ahead of what was originally supposed to be next year's presidential elections. So it makes one wonder just how far in advance these sanctions were planned. Furthermore, it can't be discounted that Turkey successfully offset what was supposed to have been an attempt to sway the vote by unexpectedly holding early elections and thwarting the U.S.'s meddling attempt. Bureaucracies such as the U.S.'s are stereotypically inflexible, and it's difficult to abruptly adapt to new timelines after something of this nature has already been decided in advance, which might be why the sanctions weren't hastily imposed right after the early election date was set, because it would have revealed Washington's intentions. Their contemporary significance is still to destabilize Turkey, though with the intention of pressuring President Erdogan to downgrade his close ties with Russia and Iran instead of directly trying to unseat him by hacking the elections. the US would prefer to overthrow him, but it's more difficult to pull off now. The worsening economic situation in the country, due to a combination of objectively pre-existing structural factors and the timed weaponization of sanctions that triggered the lira's latest slide, will predictably lead to protest that could easily turn violent and therefore produce political problems for Turkey as well, further compounding the challenges that it's forced to confront. The government is unlikely to compromise with the US, however, because there's no guarantee that doing so will truly result in sanctions relief, seeing as how the tensions between the two predate Pence's ultimatum last month to release the so-called pasture. It should therefore be expected that the US will only continue intensifying the pressure that it puts on Turkey, concurrent with the exacerbation of its existing sanctions measures on neighboring Iran, essentially pairing the two great powers together to form a single Mideast battlefield on which the US's economic warfare is fought. This will naturally bring the two countries together, but could also see both of them limiting their international influence, with Turkey pulling back from Africa in parallel with Iran doing the same for the Mashriq, though nevertheless reorienting their engagement efforts towards the golden circle of multipolar great powers, and inadvertently contributing to even more strategic blowback for the US. Alright folks, there you have it. This wraps up this week's edition of Context Countdown, and as I do every week, I want to wish each and every one of you a very nice weekend, and I hope you all tune in again next week. Thank you. Bye.